Dr. Karish, obviously, as everybody knows, editor-in-chief of Anesthesiology, goes without introduction. Needs no introduction. Thank you.
Thank you, Sasha. I appreciate the opportunity to be here. Sasha and I had several phone calls in preparation for this and scratched our heads and I said, what don't you want me to talk about? Because there's quite a bit to talk about with the journal and what we do and where we're going and how and what's important to us in terms of offering a perspective on what it is. In fact, because I have no conflicts, most of the time I don't even remember to put in a slide that says I have no conflicts. But I have no conflicts. We did something very interesting over the course of the past year, and I asked the question, what is the value proposition of anesthesiology? When I came on board 3 years ago, there was a mission statement, and I kind of looked at the mission statement, and I said, it really doesn't say what our value is. It kind of says what we do. But it doesn't say what's important to us. So we went through a very interesting exercise, and we did a series of author interviews, author surveys, reader interviews, to find out what it is that our customers think about us, and we underwent an internal process. And we came up with what we think is an answer, and what is our value proposition? And it's trusted evidence, discovery to practice. And we liked it so much, we put it on the cover of the journal as a tagline and moved it up to the very top as a message to ourselves and a message to our readers and our authors as to what we view our value proposition to our submitters, to our authors, to our readers, to the ASA, to the specialty, and frankly, beyond the specialty. So when we talk about trusted evidence, our readers said that for them, whether they are scientists or clinicians, peer-reviewed evidence was the highest value that they put in a journal and what was most important to them. The most important reason that people said, or the most common reason people said they read the journal, was that it was considered an authoritative source of information, research information, clinical practice information. And that from an attribute perspective, the readers and authors said that the highest rated attribute of the journal was that the information that was in the journal was credible. And so from that, we came away with the concept of what we do is to publish trusted evidence. And then we expanded on that just a little bit and said it's discovery to practice. And that three-word phrase really has a number of different intonations, if you will. One is that what's between the covers of the journal spans from discovery to practice. What's between the covers helps translate discovery into practice, and that we want to influence science from discovery to practice. And that now sits on the cover of every issue. And it's interesting because when I get the journal every month, I actually open it and read it, even though I've read everything in it and know what's in it. But I look at that tagline and I have two initial reactions. One is I really like it and I'm really proud of it. And the other is I'm a little intimidated because we raised the bar on ourselves and we have a lot to live up to. But you know that you've designed something well if you use it. And what's interesting is that in the past 10 months since we started this. Our editors are now asking the question, when we evaluate manuscripts, the final question comes down to when there's a conversation is this trusted evidence? And that's the bar. And I think it's really helped improve the journal, and it's helped us communicate with authors and readers about what our value proposition is. So there's a lot that I could cover today. When we talk about trusted evidence, I've listed some of the attributes that we feel fall into this bucket. Transparency of reporting, the importance of peer review, the soundness of our results, are the conclusions valid? Have we eliminated spin from those conclusions, and are they really meaningful? Is there scholarly integrity? The journal takes this very seriously. We want the content to be rich. We like the idea that people may even read it from cover to cover because they'll discover things that they didn't know and didn't know that they were interested in. And we also focus on two things, and there's richness and reach. And that is, we want high quality content, and we want it to reach as broad an audience as possible and be read by as broad an audience as possible. And we've put a tremendous amount of effort into making articles more readable. The articles that we publish fall into the category of original investigations, summative articles like reviews and clinical reviews. We publish methodology articles. It's something new for the journal this year. We call them the reader's toolbox, if you will, and this is to help people understand scientific methods, because so many of the scientific methods are developed after we had our formal education. And the original investigations are in the area of perioperative medicine, critical care, and pain, and we like to publish articles in all three of those areas. So the area that Sachin wanted me to focus on was observational studies, because that's obviously something of importance to you. And I want to give you a little bit of a history and lead you up to where we are today. In 2016, the journal published an article about reporting observational research in anesthesiology and emphasized the importance of a data analysis plan. And I simply took some of the text right out of the editorial that Jim Eisenach wrote. But it stressed the importance of data analysis plans to observational studies. Having a data analysis plan and having it constructed before accessing the data was important and of high value to the journal, because if you don't have a pre-specified data analysis plan and are doing data-driven analysis, the validity of your analysis and the validity of your conclusions may at times be less valid than you would like them to be. So this was published in an editorial in 2016. It outlined some changes in journal policy. It said that the journal would very strongly encourage authors of observational studies to develop a statistical and data analysis plan before accessing the data. It said that these plans should be considered when you evaluate the conclusions, and that going forward we would require authors transparently report in an article whether an analysis plan was developed before accessing the data. And this was a high-value statement, if you will, and one of the things that I view as important in the journal, and I say this to the editorial board, is that our role in the specialty is not simply to publish papers, but we have a leadership role and a leadership opportunity. And it is this kind of messaging which, to me, exemplifies that kind of leadership, where we help move fields forward. So after this was published, I came on shortly thereafter as the editor-in-chief, and I noticed something that was interesting. We had a very well-laid-out plan and a very well-laid-out set of requirements, except that nobody was really paying attention. Our editors were not scrutinizing articles carefully. Our authors were really not telling us whether there were data and statistical analysis plans that were written before the data were accessed. What we decided that we needed to re-message to our readers and authors that this was important. And of course, the field continues to move forward. And the field did move forward in those subsequent 3 years, and standards and practices evolved. So we came out with another policy statement and published it in the beginning of the year. And we didn't raise the bar, interestingly. All we did was to say, we're going to look at the bar a little bit more carefully. You know, we're going to shine a light on it, we're going to look at it, and we're actually going to pay attention to this because it is important. So we, in a sense, reissued the policy with a little bit stronger language and a little bit more explicit language. And we said that observational studies should be reported according to the Stroob guidelines, and that we will require explicit statements in a submitted manuscript that says whether there was a data and statistical analysis plan that was defined before the data were accessed. So we actually didn't say a lot that was new. We just kind of said it again, but said it with a little bit more clarity. And around that clarity, we outlined exactly what it was that we wanted to see. So we give our authors a multiple choice statement. And the statement says, a data analysis and statistical plan was either written and posted before the data were accessed and placed on a publicly accessible server. Pick your server of choice, clinicaltrials.gov or some other server. Or whether you wrote and filed a data and statistical analysis plan with some private entity like an IRB or some other entity. Or whether you wrote it and then date stamped it and put it on your hard drive, but you can show somebody that you wrote it and it was in existence before you accessed the data, or whether you didn't do any of that and you accessed the data first and then figured out what you were going to do to analyze it. And we don't put a value proposition on that. We simply say you have to tell us what you did, and more importantly, you have to tell your readers what you did. And then the fine print is that if you did either one, two, or three, that was had a data and statistical analysis plan, send it to us as part of the submission of a manuscript. And that's becoming relatively mainstream. If you send anything to journals like JAMA, New England Journal, you know that they insist on having that protocol package, statistical analysis plan, as part of the whole submission. We talked about some other things as well, and we asked the question, should we require pre-registration in the same way that we require registration of clinical trials? And there was a split opinion on the board. Some people thought it was a good idea, other people were not enthusiastic. So we decided that we're not going to require pre-registration of observational studies. The field may move forward and it may move in that direction, but we are not going to try and move the field in that direction. We also understand that sometimes you do look at the data, and what I like to tell trainees is talk to the data and the data will talk to you back, and they will tell you what you need to know. And sometimes we do look at data and we do find new things and we do discover things that we didn't go into discover before. And that's all well and good, and that's actually cool, and it's part of the fun of what we do. But it's also important to analyze those data appropriately and to communicate that that analysis was done not a priori, but basically post hoc. And again, we simply want that communicated in a manuscript so that it's apparent to peer reviewers and apparent to authors, and we simply ask the authors to explain what they did and why they've done it. It was interesting. We were very gratified that we led the field on this, because about 9 months after we decided to do this, the New England Journal came out and sort of said the same thing. And that was interesting, and it's always nice when you lead a field like that. So in their editorial, they more or less said the same thing. You have to submit the analysis plan with a manuscript. You have to deposit it in an online repository. You have to use appropriate methods to prevent false discovery. And if you didn't do that, the methods section has to be really transparent. And so we are consistent with the field, or another way of saying it is that we are leading the field, and I like to present it that way. And you know you're doing well when other people copy your homework. So that's the nutshell about observational reporting of observational data. So we didn't raise the bar, we're just paying a little bit more attention to it. And then the other thing I want to touch on briefly is the peer review imperative. And I'll tell you that the heart and soul of anesthesiology is the peer review process. That is really the value that we bring to the scientific literature. And there are many ways to get things published or posted or out there or whatever, but what really makes the difference is the peer review process, and we invest a tremendous amount of time and effort in the peer review process. And it's interesting, nobody else knows this, but when I pick up the journal every month, I see what's printed, but I also know what the articles looked like when they came in. And very often, the articles as they appear will sometimes look very different than they did when they were first submitted. And that quality improvement is a result of a very intensive, concerted peer review process. It's our reviewers, it's our associate editors, it's our handling editors, and it is all designed to improve the quality of the reporting and the quality of the science that we publish. So some of the things that we pay attention to in that peer review process, the title. We like short, focused, concise titles. Sometimes they can get a little long, and we ask authors to shorten them. I got an email the other day where somebody sent me a title from a couple of years ago, and they said, is this the title or is this the abstract? And so we want short, focused, pithy titles. The two most widely read parts of any article are the title and the abstract, so we put a lot of effort into making sure that the title and the abstract are high quality and communicate very effectively. And this is some of what we learned in school but may have forgotten, but we want to see a purpose for the study. Why did you do what you did? We like to see a hypothesis. Very often we'll see an abstract which consists of an introduction with half a sentence. And it's like, what? Tell us why you did it and tell us what the hypothesis was. Very simple. We want methods which describe what was done, enough so that when somebody gets to the next section of results, they can understand where the results came from. Obviously, you don't have a lot of space, you have 300 words, but we simply want enough methods that somebody can understand where the results came from. We want to see primary outcomes, and if there's enough room left over, the secondary outcomes as well, but we want that primary outcome identified. We want to see results. And we like data, we like numbers, we like statistical significance, and we like all of them packaged together. Very often we will get one of those. So very commonly we get an abstract where the results is a narrative with p-values as the every third or fourth word. And that's a style, but it's not the journal's style. We want actual descriptive statistics about the primary outcome and the statistical significance. We don't want a narrative. And then we want conclusions, not a restatement of the results, and we want conclusions that are based on the results in the results section of the abstract. Because we understand the vast majority of readers will not read further beyond that. We do statistical analysis of every paper that gets published, and we do it at the stage of initial submission. Tim Hull is the statistical editor of the journal. He'll be talking to you later, and Tim's built a phenomenal team, which adds an incredible amount of value to what gets published in the journal. We pay close attention to making sure that there's not false precision. Sometimes we will get a paper where it lists the average age of patients to 5 significant digits and 4 decimal places. And we generally think that people aren't measuring the age of their patients to the millisecond. So we insist on accurate reporting and not false precision. We've taken non-standard abbreviations out of the articles. When I took over, an abstract was usually 250 three-letter acronyms, and it was written in machine language and code, and nobody could understand it. And we've done a novel thing. We now require people to use words instead of acronyms and abbreviations, and it simply made the articles much more readable. We make sure that there's no spin in the conclusions of the article, and I could give you a whole lecture on spin, but I won't. So we spent a lot of time on the speed and quality of our peer review, and we put emphasis on both of those. It's not either or. We want our authors to highly participate in the peer review process, and what we really want them to do is to participate actively so that we get everything done on a revision and not have to go back for further revisions, and so that we can move things forward as quickly as possible. So in the little bit of time that I had, hopefully I've given you a little bit of a perspective on what we do, what we are, what's important, and finally, that we want to publish really high-quality science that will move, drive, and inform patient care. So we ask for your submissions. So Sachin, thank you for the opportunity, and I'll come back and answer questions. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Evan. Next up, we've got Hugh. Number two. I can't forget that numbering order of things.
So thanks, Sachin, for the invitation, and thanks to the committee. I want to, can I get away from that? Yeah. I want to thank Evan for saying a lot of the same things I would say. Fortunately, I did not include those foundational points in my talk. I instead chose to focus a little bit on some of the observational research that we're publishing in the British Journal of Anesthesia. I do have a few conflicts. Number one is I'm editor-in-chief of the British Journal of Anesthesia, which is in competition with the previous editor-in-chief. I get some funding for my research, and I'm a consultant for Elsevier, who also publishes our journal, but on their Clinical Key platform. And I'm on the executive board of MPOG. This might be the talk that I have the most conflicts of any talk I give. Let me just brief summary of the British Journal of Anesthesia if you're not familiar with it. It is published in a former country of the European Union. And it has quite an international board of editors. You can see on the left, most of our papers, well, it's pretty much evenly split between, of the papers we accept, evenly split between the UK and the US. The rest are mostly Europe. We also publish in the same areas as anesthesiology, critical care, pain, perioperative medicine. So I'm going to divide my talk into two parts. Regarding observational research, we're also undergoing a change, I think, in how our editorial board handles these papers, what our expectations are from authors, and what we're getting from authors in terms of how they're adhering to best practices in publication, as Evan covered in his talk. And then I want to just discuss some examples from recent papers, and interestingly, there was a whole flurry that will be coming out in November. And I can share those with you. So let's get right into it. So one of the things that the British Journal publishes quite a bit, because of our affiliation with the Royal College of Anesthetists, which is the sort of like the ABA in the UK, and their They are our biggest subscriber in the sense that all the fellows of the college get a subscription to the British Journal of Anesthesia. They've been conducting these national audits since 2003. And this is a form of observational research. They're prospective audits. They are focused on specific topics that are selected by a group, a committee. They pick a lead and they go through a process that includes a baseline survey as a benchmark. Then they do an activity survey of current practice and they create a registry and then analyze their data, usually over a year, and report that out. So the last four have been NAP 3, 4, 5, and 6. One was on central neuraxial blocks, one on airway, one on awareness under anesthesia, and one on anaphylaxis that was conducted in 2018 and we just published in July this year. So how do audits fit into the sort of ecosystem of observational research? I think they are probably the most pragmatic in the sense that they are analysis of current practice. So they fall into this scheme that was outlined by Michael Avedon and Paul Miles. Sorry, their fonts are low, and that's one of my issues with our journal is that the figure preparation drives me nuts. But the T2 are high-quality surveys, and then those link to implementation research and finally guidelines and standards. For this to really have an impact, there needs to be a feedback, though, and follow-up surveys to see if there are changes in practice as a result of these audits. So here's some of the papers that came out of the anaphylaxis audits, and what they did was the power of audits in the UK is that they have all the National Health Service hospitals, so they can collect data, although they don't use an electronic medical record, they can collect data over 80% of the procedures done in the UK. And that gives them a really good window into what's happening. Some of the cons are that this is usually driven by leads at each National Health Service hospital, so it involves self-reporting. The data is paper. It has to be processed pretty much manually and converted to electronic format. And then it's hard to say when practice changes following an audit like this, was the information that was gathered leading to that change, or was there a trajectory that practice was changing anyway? So you could say that the changes in airway management that have occurred over the last decade really would have happened without NAP4 or not. So it's hard to know that. So you get into this post hoc fallacy argument whether what follows was really due to the research that came before. The also a con is that many health systems really don't have the opportunity to do this kind of broad scoping review. So the post hoc fallacy is an example here where it's a fact that people exposed to water will die. So that's the kind of logical evidence argument you can get into with audit data. But a lot of interesting things have come from this. So this was one of the papers from NAP6 looking at the clinical features of anaphylaxis. And anaphylaxis has been changing over time in terms of what the allergens are and what the clinical features are to some extent. And that there was some really interesting information on that. So on the left you can see the most common presenting sign is hypotension. But then, rash and desaturation, bronchospasm, and tachycardia are all about equally common, maybe 50 to 60%. The most common allergens, no big surprise, were antibiotics and neuromuscular blocking agents. But what's interesting nowadays is that chlorhexidine is one of the most common allergens and often not recognized. Of the neuromuscular blocking agents, pretty similar between rocuronium and atricurium, but succinylcholine being the third most common. So How do we deal with these, you know, reviewing these? These are really observational. There is a pre-planned process for gathering the data, and these are really large observational epidemiological studies. We're, like anesthesiology, trying to move more toward pre-planned. Some authors are very good at that. But I think in the end, most of these observational studies are hypothesis generating anyway. We have a statement in our instructions really also emphasizing the importance of following the strobe checklist. You can find that on our website. So let me just show you a couple examples of some of the observational data we've been publishing. So actually Tim was involved in this paper that came out of the Boston Hospitals. Association between intraoperative opioid administration and 30-day readmission. And even the title says that it was a pre-specified analysis of registry data. So this is really rigorous. It's coming from the anesthesiology statistical editor, so we would expect no less. They found some very interesting findings, which was on the left, that there was a huge variation between anesthesiologists in the dosing of opioids for surgery. And I think the maybe not totally surprising that high intraoperative opioid dose was a modifiable factor that could lead to improved outcomes if the doses were reduced. That's the implications from their study. It's quite a large study. They looked at almost 154,000 surgical cases. As an international journal, we also publish data from international registries. This one's from ISOS. And they were looking at the association of use of the surgical safety checklist and patient outcomes after surgery in a global context. And the findings were that patients who were exposed to the checklist had better postoperative outcomes. But this could, again, hypothesis generating part of this is that it could also be due to the fact that those who got the checklist were in a hospital that just had higher quality care. So I'll finish up with some examples from the November issue. So this is hot off the press. And we have several different observational studies that are published in this journal that I think are all quite interesting. Three of them are from the quality and patient safety section of the journal. I'll just go briefly through these. So this was a true observational study from the Danish landmark, Danish registry of patients who are getting hip and knee arthroplasties. And they looked at 16,000 patients or so and compared days alive out of hospital at 30 days after hospital at 30 days versus 90 days as an indicator for post-op complications. And what they found was that measuring at 30 days was just as good as 90 days. You don't pick up any more complications really by waiting another 2 months. Not surprisingly, the days alive was lower in higher risk patients. And more of the complications were medical than surgical, which is interesting. This is another one. This was from our colleagues across the street in New York at HSS, looking at outcomes after or joint arthroplasty again, based on the experience of the anesthesiologist and the surgeons. And they were looking for, this is a retrospective study based on their registry at Hospital for Special Surgery. And they found that there was really no association between outcomes and the experience of the anesthesiologist, but there was an association with outcomes for surgeons who had case volumes of less than 50. So not surprising, but it is a useful piece of evidence. This is a study from WashU and Michael Avedan's group looking at using machine learning to analyze perioperative data in order to predict outcomes. And this is, I think, a really interesting direction that anesthesiology is going in. We have another paper coming out in a couple of months on a very similar topic. So what they did was take over 95,000 patients from the WashU system and divide them into three groups, a training group, a validation group, and a testing group, and try to see if there are any aspects of perioperative data that can predict postoperative mortality compared to the conventional tools. And they did find that they could generate a model using machine learning that was more predictive than, say, the Charlson index. And this is the one that I think will be in December. A similar study from UCLA also using machine learning to predict outcome. And this one, 53,000 patients from UCLA. And applying a different model, but same concept, to look at both preoperative data and perioperative data to predict mortality. And again, it was more predictive than the conventional model. So I think we're going to see much more real-time evidence in our perioperative space of what things are happening to the patient that are going to be affecting their outcome. Some of them will be modifiable, so I think this will be a very useful approach. So in order to leave 5 minutes for discussion, I'll finish up and just summarize by saying that the BJA, like anesthesiology, publishes a wide variety of papers. We've been fortunate in being associated with the national audit projects in the UK and have published quite a few audits that have turned into major, have driven major practice guidelines. And we're also publishing more and more retrospective observational studies based on large data that is in evolution, I think, as Evan nicely covered in terms of how we approach these papers, requiring pre-analysis plans and more and pre-registration of the analysis plan. So thank you. If you want to come by and discuss, I'll be with one of our editors at the BJA booth at the meeting, and I'd be happy to take questions, I guess, with Evan.
Okay. Yeah.
Any questions from the audience? What is one thing that you hope to see different 3 years from now in your journals when it comes to these types of papers that you're seeing the evolution, but if you could, you know, wave a magic wand and like every paper did blank, what would that be?
So I think we have, for us, we're a little different from anesthesiology in that our editors have decision-making power. So I get papers that are accepted that don't follow the guidelines, for example, and I'm like, how did that happen? It's a little hard to reel that in sometimes. So I think a lot of my job is to bring the editorial board along and to meet these standards. But I think Evan nicely put it in terms of the rigor of pre-specifying a plan, I think is a very important thing. Some of the papers I showed you did that. I was thinking of going through and analyzing each one in terms of how they met our own criteria, but it would have been disappointing and depressing. So I don't think, that's why I say I don't think we're there yet. So I'd say in 3 years, I hope we're there.
Yeah, I think that what I would like to see is continued and growing emphasis on peer review. And another way of saying that is I don't want to see the devaluation of peer review. And in many ways, peer review as a concept is under threat today, and it is being challenged more than any other time in the history of scholarly publication. And it's being challenged by predatory journals. It's being challenged by the concept of preprints. It's being challenged by the publication industry being challenged broadly because of certain business practices. And there is a potential that peer review will become devalued to the point, and if you could take this to its illogical extreme, all of us could simply create our own website and put our stuff on the website, call it good, and move on. And so I don't think that that works towards the creation of trusted evidence, and I don't think that works towards the improvement of science and the improvement of patient care. So I would like to see greater emphasis and value on peer review. I would like to see our journal get thicker, in a sense, and I use that as a surrogate for the growth and vigor of research in the specialty, which is also facing some tough times. And so it's really both of those things in many ways that, that I would like to see as a health report, if you will, going forward, whether it's 1 year, 3 years, or 5 years.
I wanted you to tie those two concepts together. Joel Meyer from University of Arkansas. So the pre-specified analytic plan, I think, goes a long way towards raising the quality of our observational studies that are submitted. But at the same time, folks don't always anticipate what readers will be interested in. And so part of peer review is to really think about what data is here and what could be done with that data. How much do you encourage or discourage additional analyses when you reach out to your peer reviewers and how should the editors be thinking about that?
The peer review process will help craft and refine and improve papers. There are times where through the review process, reviewers may suggest additional types of analysis, and that's towards improving the quality of the data, the quality of the reporting, or the quality of the conclusions. When that additional analysis is done and called for, we simply require that it be stated as such in the manuscript so that there is transparency to that reporting. Part of what we do is we discover. And what we do is discovery in science, it's not engineering. And we need to allow ourselves that space to discover things and to find out what we didn't necessarily intend to discover, but to be able to report it and to report it accordingly. That doesn't mean that you can change the primary outcome after you've analyzed the data, and you lose style points for that. But we certainly appreciate the value of discovering things, but we also want them to be very clearly and transparently reported.
So I would agree with that. I mean, I can't emphasize too much how important peer review is, and we really do depend on the hard work and unrewarded work of our peer reviewers. Also, the quality of our authors and submitting high quality work. And that's why we have no hard and fast rules about these things. I mean, if there may be a post hoc analysis that finds something very interesting, if the reviewers and the editors agree that that's interesting, it might have potential impact and significance that would outweigh the fact that maybe it's not as rigorous as a fully pre-specified plan. So all these things get taken into account and balanced, I think, in the final decision.
Long ago, most of us, including me, learned something called Gresham's Law. Bad money drives out good money. You talked about the proprietary journals. What's to stop them from eating our lunch, the fear you expressed?
It's the peer review and the editorial board, really. I mean, that's what separates us from a blog. Yeah. You know, it's you know, anybody can make a journal nowadays and put it on the web and say whatever they want. It's the recognition and authoritativeness of the board and the reviewers that drive it.
Right. And I would say, frankly, it's the authors who make that decision, because it is authors who decide where they're going to send their work. So I would say that individually and collectively, it's the people in this room who will make the decision as to whether predatory journals survive and thrive, or whether peer-reviewed journals will be what are valued.
Question. Hi, thank you for your excellent talks. Rob Schoenberger from Yale. I have a short comment and then maybe a longer question. A short comment would be that I would like to encourage the emphasis on the normativity of transparency in the way we as a community communicate the analytic plans of our studies. And Dr. Karas, you were very clear that you don't put a normative spin on the different multiple choice options, although there may be one embedded in many of the judgments that follow from that. The key value is transparency, with the acknowledgement that many times, say, the association of childhood aspirin intake with Reye's syndrome is something that was not pre-specified, and there are many historical examples, as we know, but that the key value is transparency. And you said it, but I feel like often, just this is the comment, we take that key value of transparency and forget that that's really what we're after, and jump to, you must have a pre-specified plan. It's nice to have a pre-specified plan, and then sometimes you didn't, and the transparency that's involved is part of the peer review. The question I have is, given the importance of peer review to evaluate issues like this and your statements about the threats to peer review, do you have any thoughts about ways of rewarding what was stated as the unrewarded job of the peer reviewer? Thanks.
You go first.
Yeah. I'm going to bring a stack of dollars next time, or pounds. So now there's not, you know, I think the biggest reward in peer review is the privilege of seeing work in its early stage, as Evan mentioned, like, and this, to engage with the experts who are the editors in helping to improve the paper. And I think that's an two-way education. So I think there's that sort of scholarly value. I think there's also the commitment to academic anesthesiology and making sure that the work that gets published in the best journals is the best work and it's valid. So, you know, about all we can do is make our thank you emails consistent with Publons or whatever other program you use to keep track of what you do. And then it's up to your institution to decide whether they value that or not. And I know that's often a problem. It's not really valued so much by tenure committees, promotions committees, or whatever, but that's a decision I think that each person has to make. And it does affect how engaged some people are.
Yeah, I agree. There's interestingly, there is a whole field which now deals with peer review, and if we look at the collective effort which goes into peer review across the world, it is massive. The average peer reviewer, assuming they answer the surveys correctly, spends 5 hours reviewing a manuscript. From reading and writing and things like that, and that's a tremendous amount of effort, and it's largely pro bono, right? If you think about what we do, there are very few fields where we get people to contribute massive amounts of their highest intellectual abilities for free, but we all do it, and we do it because it adds value to the specialty. We do it because, you know, there's a switch that happens in many people's heads the first time they get asked to review a manuscript. directly from the journal. It's like, wow, they really like me. They value me. I must have accomplished something if people are asking my opinion. And the more you do this, the more you help participate in the process of moving a field forward. The rewards are not financial. I think the issues of how institutions deal with this, the appointments and promotions process, frankly, that's an institutional issue. And I used to be an institutional official, so I used to deal with it from that side, which prepared me well for now dealing with it from this side. But to understand that the journals don't own and can't be responsible for how institutions view, value, incentivize, and reward participation in a peer review process. There are now mechanisms for recognizing it and quantifying it and communicating it, like Publons, and we allow all of our reviewers to participate in that. But I think it's really a very wonderful and special process that so many people are willing to contribute so much time and effort to help others who they don't know improve their work.
And if you're really good at it, we may invite you to write an editorial so you get to do even more work for
yeah.
free.
I just want to say thank you to Evan and Hugh for that time.